history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories right in your midst that really need to be told, and we'll never hear them unless we take the time to ask a few questions and listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And today I'm in Modesto, California, home for the last 47 years, to Bill Koenig. He's originally from Grand Rapids, Michigan, a very different climate from Central California. We're going to hear about what he did with the 86th Infantry Division in Europe during World War II. But let's start on in Grand Rapids. Growing up as a young boy and living through the Great Depression, did you have a concept of what was happening then? Did you notice any difference in those Depression years?
Yeah, the man next door was laid off, out of a job, and I can remember my folks hiring him. So he got a little money coming in to paint the bathroom. Then the road building started with Roosevelt. And so all of a sudden we got a new sewer down the street, and men doing all pick and shovel work in a shovel. So you got some new work coming through the place, kept people busy.
And it was you and your younger brother. How much younger?
4 years.
So you got to beat him up a little bit then.
Yes.
I appreciate your honesty. Most people say, "Nah, I didn't do that." Can you give us a sense of what life was like growing up? What kinds of things you did or the dreams you had?
It was a very frugal life. My folks had, both of them, Dutch descent. Grandparents, the whole set of them, had come over from the Netherlands prior to 1900. My dad was World War I vet and didn't serve very long. He had a heart murmur, and they sent him home. Both coming out of Depression, 1900 depressions. My mother was a cigar maker, $10 a week. And so the money was always very valuable thing to us. I saved newspapers and magazines. I got 10 bucks 100 pounds for newspapers and 15 bucks for 100 pounds of magazines. Take them to Casey the junk man and came back real big smile on my face.
That could buy a lot of candy in those years. Do you remember having some ambitions back then, thinking, hey, when I grow up, this is what I want to do with my life?
Not really. Took an architecture class in high school, and I thought I'd become an architect. There was never a question whether or not I would go to school after high school. I was going to go. Both my parents were 8th grade graduates, and they were very education-oriented. So it was always, you were going to go to college.
You mentioned the Dutch heritage with your grandparents immigrating from the Netherlands. Did that mean you learned a little bit of that language growing up?
Not really. The only time I heard it is when my mother and father wanted to say something and went out of kids to know.
Came in handy. Well, and you mentioned school. You would have still been in high school when Pearl Harbor happened.
Pearl Harbor, yeah.
Do you remember how you heard about that?
I'd gone to a youth group at church. It was Sunday afternoon. I came home and opened up the door to go in the house. My mother says, "There's a war on. There's war. We were attacked." And so that's the way I learned of it.
Did it register for you, or was it kind of
not
hard to
really,
understand?
Not really, but she gave me an awful funny look because she knew I would be in it sooner or later. She had gone through World War I, of course.
Yeah.
And prior to 1941, a lot of guys coming out of high school went into the Army to get the National Guard pay. And so they were activated. 32nd Infantry Division was activated quite early. So it was, the war was a very real thing. My mother had a pail of sand in the attic to put out a firebomb.
Wow.
Certain men on the street were fire wardens and that sort of thing. So you realize there was a war on.
And when you say the guys who had signed up for the National Guard were activated, so would those have been some of the guys ahead of you in school that you had known growing up or seen around
my
town?
My cousin was one of those. The 32nd Division, 126th Infantry Regiment, was the one in Grand Rapids. And so some of those were in school with me. You had to be 18 to get into it. You know, you were very aware that there was a war on. There was rationing. Sugar was rationed. Tires were rationed. Mm-hmm. Gasoline was rationed.
So how soon was it that you started thinking, hey, when I'm old enough, maybe I'm going to get involved in this?
When, in high school, 12th grade, as I said, I went to the JC, local JC, and found this program, ASTP. And so this was an opportunity to get an education and be in the Army both.
You're only 17 years old now.
Yes.
How'd your mother feel about that?
Well, she would encourage it. Mother, I had a very patriotic mother. There wasn't a, growing up, I can't remember a parade that we missed. And I still see her as a little boy. I see her when I go to a parade. You know, I stiffen up when the flag goes by, and it just happens. That's the way I was taught.
So ASTP, Army Specialized Training Program, this was happening all over the country. And what was it about that program that attracted you? What were they promising you? As a result,
an education.
So you enlist, and you're going to get a college education before you ever fight.
Yes.
That was the deal.
That was the deal.
So where'd they send you?
Up to Northern Michigan, Michigan Tech. We had our first semester up there, and it was just a little bit advanced high school, first freshman JC kind of the programs. So that was the course. We began to get physically fit. You had a daily exercise program. You had a three-mile run every Friday morning. And so you began to do, physically, you began to get in shape.
Did it ever occur to you that whatever was happening in the war could cut this short? Was that even a thought in your mind?
No.
You're thinking, hey, I'm going to be in school for the next few years.
Yeah.
But how long were you in school till they changed the deal on you?
Well, I got the first semester in, and then they changed the deal in the middle of our basic training program.
And so after a semester of basic engineering studies up there at Michigan Tech, they send you all the way down to Fort Benning, Georgia.
Yes.
And this is the basic training, but you're still thinking, okay, after basic training, I'm going back to school.
Yes.
So what was that basic training like?
More physical fitness and then Army tactics. Fort Benning is the infantry school, so you learned all of the how to parade, salute, and all that sort of stuff, and the regimen of charges and corporals and all that sort of thing. We're telling you, tell you what to do.
Was any of that challenging for you?
Not really.
Your parents had already toughened you up, huh?
You just said yes or no, sir.
Uh-huh. You're at Fort Benning, and you find out, okay, I don't get to go back to school. How did they break that news to you, and how did you feel about it?
Not particularly upset.
No?
No. You're a young kid, and we got weekly lectures from young lieutenants on the shape of the war and what was going on. And you can remember how the Russians fell back and the Germans took ground is all they got, and the Russians kept going back and back. No, I didn't. I can't remember anything about the Japan at that point in time. I don't think they were that active to begin with. But
basically, you're still a teenager, and all of a sudden, you go from being in school for a few years to finding out, hey, they need bodies in the war, and I'm going to be heading overseas pretty soon. And you were fine with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're invincible at 18.
We would find out, I'm sure. And you mentioned your cousin, who had been called up immediately after Pearl Harbor. Did you have an awareness of what he was doing or how he was doing overseas?
Yes, because as I said, they put him right in the 126th Infantry, and they immediately went to Australia, and then they became involved in New Guinea and that sort of thing. And kids I went to school with, and pretty soon some of them were dying. And that family lost two already. That family lost one. Every other house that had somebody in the service had a little flag in the service flag, a little blue star.
Right.
Gold star was death, silver star was captured or missing. And so when you would go to church, the church had a big flag in front of it with all the kids that were in the service. And then every once in a while, a gold star, silver star would appear in that flag. So you were very, very well aware what was happening.
Well, and that had to be sobering. These are guys that you grew up with, you knew.
And... Oh, yeah.
Not much older than you, and they're gone.
Yeah, they're gone.
So now you know this is real, and you're going to be involved. And where'd they send you from Fort Benning?
Louisiana, and Camp Livingston, Louisiana, which is now a state park, I think, but it was a swamp then. And you learned all about chiggers and that sort of stuff.
I wonder how many of our listeners know about chiggers. If they've never been in the South, they probably don't.
Probably don't.
Did you learn the hard way?
You had tick bites and chiggers, yeah. You had the ointment, the spray or the insect repellent. And the green one always got insect repellent. You'd tell him to put it on the fly of his pants, and it was very, very stinging. And you sweat for 3 days.
That's cruel.
Well, when you did it to a sergeant, you had a lot of fun with it.
Oh, my goodness. So it sounds like everything you've described so far, it almost sounds like an adventure for you, that you were enjoying this.
It is. You're invincible at that age.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, looking back at it. Yeah, it was just fun. I had a good time.
So you didn't get yourself in any trouble then?
No.
Was that because you didn't get caught or you didn't try hard enough?
Didn't get caught.
Uh-huh. Anything you want to fess up to now, all these years later?
No, not really.
And as you're training and going through these different spots, did you start to form some relationships and bonds with some of these other young men?
Yeah. One young man and I enlisted together. We met on the road to Detroit when we had to enlist. His name was Ralph Cole, K-O-L-L. I was K-O-N.
Ah.
And so the two of us stayed together through our entire Army experience all the way to being discharged and came home on the train together.
How about that?
Every time I was on KP, he was on KP. We got our furloughs together. We got our promotions pretty much close together. And I can tell you a little bit about more of that later.
All right. So you're in Camp Livingston, enjoying the swamp.
Enjoying the swamp. You then get shipped to California.
Uh-huh.
And I think it was 30 days aboard a ship off San Diego. We went on and, you know, climbing up and down the nets on the side of the ship and then into the little boats. And then Umbriago when you hit the shore.
Now explain that for us. I don't know if our listeners know what you're talking about when you say that. What was the origin of this new declaration when you're coming off the landing craft?
We had an Italian major of the battalion, and he was enamored with Jimmy Durante.
Uh-huh.
And he knew that the paratroopers yelled Geronimo when they jumped out of their plane, so the guys on the ground had to yell Umbriago to make up for it when you hit the beach.
That's funny.
Then there came, you know, you took that training took a month or so more, and then several different camps coming up the Oregon coast, and each one that had a pier, they would regularly jump us off, and we'd swim to shore off the end of the pier, just so that everybody knew swimming. You had a life preserver.
So you're doing all this practice, and I'm sure in the back of your mind you're thinking, boy, I'm going to have to do this for real at some point.
Yeah, but you never dwelled on that.
All right.
You don't dwell on that sort of thing.
When did you find out you were heading overseas?
December of 44.
So this is right about when the Battle of the Bulge is happening.
Battle of the Bulge, and Eisenhower needed one more division, and so we were supposed to hit Okinawa from California. That's why we had that amphibious training. Well, uh-huh. Eisenhower needed one more division. It's really an amazing thing. They moved 15,000 people between like Christmas and by the 6th of January, we were aboard a ship in Boston going over to Europe.
Wow. You know, I've talked to other guys from the 86th. I don't know if I've ever caught on to that distinction before. But now with hindsight, you know what happened at Okinawa. You know how many lives were lost.
Yeah.
And you guys would have been making that landing, is what you're saying.
We would have made that landing. We were trained for it.
I'm not saying it was a picnic where you ended up, but I wonder what would have happened to Bill Koning if you had to go to Okinawa.
No idea.
Yeah. So you get this other curveball, and they take you from California over to Boston, and now you're heading over to Europe.
Yes.
What was that journey across the Atlantic like for you?
For a land lover, you look at all of that water, and you think about submarines, and the Germans had a bunch of them.
Mm-hmm.
But you were in convoy, but the thought did go through your head that they, you know, if they sunk that ship.
Mm-hmm.
It was cold. It was January. You did your exercise out on the deck. It was cold out there. I can remember that. Landed in Le Havre. We were in tents in France for about 6 weeks. That would be January through February, I think. It was cold, real cold. You had every piece of clothing on inside your little barracks bag and everything else. And, we were living in tents.
Colder than Grand Rapids?
Oh, yeah. It was cold in France.
And I guess I should have you explain. All of you've mentioned, anyways, the 86th Infantry Division. But that's a whole lot of guys, and you've got regiments and battalions and companies. What was your specific duty as you understood it?
I was the so-called first scout in the 3rd Squad of the 2nd Platoon of I Company of the 341st Regiment and 86th Infantry Division.
Uh-huh.
And so as first scouts, you're supposed to see them before you see you.
Yeah, and that's one of the most precarious positions anyone could have in your whole division.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. First scout. Yeah. You are the tip of the spear in that scenario.
But landing in Le Havre and cold, we went to a bar on the Rhine River, and the whole group was, they just walk into these places and you take over. And so this bar had a beautiful patio out looking over the Rhine. There was a normal infantry squad had maybe, was supposed to be 12. We had maybe 10, 9 guys. Look out and see Germans on the other side, very small things going past on bicycles once in a while. And so we were just sitting there. And along about the 1st of April was Easter. And they asked for volunteers to a patrol to go across the Rhine River and pick up a person, find somebody that knew what outfit was over there. Now, why they had to know the name of the German outfit, I don't know. But we were supposed to get a German prisoner and bring him back with us.
That sounds like a pretty mundane mission. No big deal.
No big deal.
And we're going to hear Bill's memories from that mission, which almost claimed his life, when we come back. You can also read about that Easter Sunday patrol in the book One Soldier's War by Ralph Cole, that buddy from Grand Rapids that Bill met on the train to Detroit and stayed close to throughout the war. I have that book linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's conversation with Bill Koenig of Modesto, California, originally from Grand Rapids, Michigan. He served with the 86th Infantry Division in World War II. That was the Black Hawk Division, which during its short time in the European theater built quite a legacy. The first action came along the Rhine River between Cologne and Bonn. Bill and so many other young and inexperienced soldiers had been packed into those 40 and 8 train cars and taken to this location. And on Easter Sunday, April 1st, 1945, word came that volunteers were needed for a dangerous patrol across the Rhine with the intent of capturing a German prisoner from the other side to gain intelligence.
You know, it starts at the battalion, it comes bouncing, and finally it's our platoon. The platoon leader volunteered for it. And so then it's now who in the platoon is going to go. And so they ask for volunteers, and my squad leader, who I admired very much, volunteered, so I volunteered. Jim Karakoff from Norfolk volunteered. He was our BAR man. And our assistant squad leader volunteered. So that was 1, 2, 3 out of that squad. And there was another one out of the first squad, just a regular infantryman, and another one out of the third platoon who volunteered. And so you got the leadership of the second platoon pretty well taken care of, at least the third squad taken care of. And so there were like 5 of this infantrymen and 3 engineers. And I can remember standing on they had a boat ramp going down to the Rhine River. And stand there and look around. There's just about 10 of us. And you think about that. Maybe I'm not coming back. That's when it hit me.
That's the first time you thought that?
Yeah.
I can see why.
It's the first exposure, really, to anything. And so it's the 1st of April. It's Easter Sunday. So they say, let's go. And so we run down to down the boat ramp, hop in the boat, motor won't start. Quick, get the paddle. So we get the paddles out, we paddle across. Just before we get to the other side, a machine gun burst comes through the boat. I don't know how he missed as much as he did, but he did hit my squad leader. And I look down and here's Cowboy Letro, his cowboy is his nickname, lying in the bottom of the boat, his face all blood. And so we get to the other side, and we hop out. We run up the bank, and there was a big church wall, oh, maybe 30 feet high, big church wall. And just as we get ready to go into the town, which was a little path going into the town, another burst of that machine gun comes through and takes out the assistant squad leader. And so now we've lost two already. And I quickly jumped into a hole that eddy that the spring thaw had made in the bottom there. And Kirchhoff, the BAR man, jumped right on top of me. He landed on my back. He said, "Oh, just like the best hotel in town." And so we're stuck in this little hole in the ground. And I'm looking right up a boat ramp into the town. So I stick my head up to see what's going to happen. And I fake a little ding on the top of my head. And the machine gunner's gone again. So I duck back down into the hole. And I pick up my gun, and I was using a friend's gun. It was a BAR, an automatic rifle. And I put it over the edge of the hole because I'm going to fight back. I pull the trigger, and it's supposed to go brrrr. It went pop. Dumb thing won't work. Mm-hmm. One shot at a time instead of automatic. So about this time, the lieutenant says, this isn't going to work. We better go back. So we jump up and go back. And so now we left one man there, the assistant squad leader. He was killed. And the rest of us run back in the boat, paddle back across the Rhine River. And when we land, then the Germans now have got big artillery. And boy, they start shooting at that spot where we landed. That's the first cannon exposure we had. And boy, he was accurate as all get out. Now, I don't know how much damage he did to anybody else, but our group survived. But it was just a real touch and go in their artillery like you wouldn't believe. So we knew what war was all about.
I guess so. I didn't want to interrupt you in any of that. But I do have a few questions. You say your assistant squad leader was killed, and it was your squad leader who was hit before that in the boat?
That's right.
But he survived?
Yes, he survived. The bullet went in his mouth. I saw him after the war. Took out two teeth, went all the way down his neck, through his shoulder, and they took it out of his arm where you have your, what they call them, angel wings or something.
Yeah.
Took it out way down in his halfway to his elbow.
Wow.
He survived, became a refrigeration repairman in Tennessee.
Wow. But you're exposed right here. This is your first real taste of combat, and yep. You're already seeing one guy you said you really admired almost killed, another guy in your squad killed, and you mentioned a ding on top of your helmet. Now, that wasn't someone with a little mallet playing with you.
He was shooting at me.
That was a machine gun bullet
that
hit your helmet.
Yes.
But fortunately at the right angle that it didn't penetrate.
That far from the bottom of the helmet, so by 2 inches lower, he would add me.
But it didn't even, it just bounced right off.
Bounced off.
Is that something that got your attention at the time, or is that one that night later on you're thinking, boy,
it got my attention. I kept my head down from then on.
Yeah, that's a little too close for comfort. So you guys had gone over to try to determine which German unit was there, grab a prisoner.
Yeah.
You realized, we're not going to get a prisoner. We got to get out of here or else we're going to be dead.
Yeah, the lieutenant realized that.
Uh-huh. And then when you got back to your side, their artillery zeroed in on you. So what does that mean? Their shells going off right by you?
Yeah, they had us pretty well zeroed in. So you get down on the ground and you sweat it out. A guy from another part of the platoon, when we landed, they could see we had a wounded person aboard. And so you're on the edge of a river now. And just up the river, there was a cultivated field. And we hollered for the medic. And the guy that the Jeep driver in our company came bouncing across that field, and it's under heavy fire now. He volunteered and came bouncing across that field to get to Cali, pick him up. And fortunately, they gave him a Silver Star for it.
Well, they should. Yeah. He risked his life to save another.
Yeah.
But I'm still thinking about you being a 19-year-old kid. You're keeping your head down. You're ducking. But there's nothing you can do to stop that artillery from hitting you. If it lands on you, you're gone.
You're done.
So what are you doing with your head down? Are your eyes closed? Are you saying a prayer? Are you just gritting your teeth? What are you doing?
I don't recall any particular thoughts other than get as low as you can get. Get everything but your heels and your helmet. I don't have any thought now. Later on, we had more exposure to that sort of thing and mortar fire and all that. And got caught once in the middle of the street. And this is first off, I said my squad leader got hit and the assistant squad leader got killed. They suddenly made me the squad leader. And here's a 19-year-old kid, the squad leader. Never done anything like that before in my life. And I got 6-8 guys reporting to me.
Yeah.
Now, the group gets these three new people coming in, replacements, because we were down and we lost two, and we were only about 8 to begin with. Mm-hmm. And the three are very, you remember them. One that was a 33-year-old Boston man, wife and three kids at home, and later on he got killed. Mm. One, he stuck real close to me all the time. And finally, one night, we were sitting outside somewhere on guard duty outside some farmhouse, black as night, couldn't see the end of your gun. And I felt him shaking. I said, "What's the matter, Pat?" He says, "I'm scared." I said, "Well, I am too." He said, "Yeah, but I'm only 15. And so Pat went home the next day.
You ratted him out, or he ratted himself out?
No, we ratted him out. We got rid of him quick.
Wow.
And everybody cooperated in getting rid of him because 15-year-old kid don't belong out there.
Yeah, and he had obviously lied
about
his age.
So now that's another guy out of my group. So now I'm a squad leader that's supposed to have 12 people, and we got about 7 left now.
Oof.
And so from then on, when I talked to my friends, I still talked to one guy. We had it easy. We surely did. Our job was, occasionally we were in the front line, but it was never that much exposure. The war was just about over. It's the 1st of April, the war's over the 1st of May. So let's say we had 6 weeks of combat. Yeah, we walked and rode. We ride all night in trucks and walk all day. And we were cleaning out places. We were getting rid of people out of houses. We'd kick people out of houses because we didn't want to leave anybody behind us.
Sure.
As you go through. So we really... Never were we, again, in a position where it was boom, 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 and we could see who we were shooting at. And most of us never even had to shoot anymore because we were clearing houses.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, exposed to fire. I can remember crossing bridge one time and a mortar shell plopped in the mud right next to the bank.
Didn't go off?
Didn't go off.
Wow.
It hit the mud. Just went... But, you know, it was walk all day, ride all night, walk all day, ride all night. I've got 6 guys reporting to me, 7, 8. You mentioned, what do you do when you're in the middle of the street and you get caught? You lay down and you sweat. Or you stand and get down in a doorway somewhere. This one particular incident where I was just 2-3 days out there someplace, and one guy said, "Hey, Conan, go on, Sergeant, go over there. Wally, something's the matter with Wally." So I look around. Here's Wally laying in the middle of the street, shaking like a leaf. I run up to him. He says, "If I get out of this alive, my kid's going to Sunday school every Sunday. If I get out of this alive, my kid's going to Sunday school every Sunday." So this 19-year-old philosopher that I am, you know, with all this training I've had, I say, "Here, have a cigarette." I had to get him calmed down and get him out of the middle of the street.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just funny stories like that that come back and haunt you.
And what was it, do you think, that enabled you to avoid those moments of panic where it's just so consuming that these guys couldn't function and couldn't move on?
I don't know. You survive. You look for a place to survive is what you do. Mm-hmm. And so I say you get down next to the curb. That's all that's there. You get a chance then when it's not something coming at you, you quick get into the doorway of the house next door or a hole that you see someplace next to it. If you're in the country, it's down in a ditch.
You mentioned that mortar shell that lands in the mud next to you. I don't want to assume something that's not true, but it sounds like had that mud been a little harder, you wouldn't be here.
It would have gone off, yeah.
And it would have killed you.
Yeah, but I realize that now, but then I'm lucky.
Yeah, no big deal.
It spurred me on. I ran a little bit faster.
How exhausting was it?
That's one of the things that... I'm going to talk to you later about some other thing, but that's sure. One of the things is you're dead tired all the time. And so when you go to sleep, you sleep. And if the sleep is 2 hours or 6 hours, you're sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
And you've never been so tired as you are. And yet you can run just as fast as you ever run. And you can get around and you can yell and everything else just as fast. You've got a lot of junk hanging on you. You know, you got food and canteen and all that stuff, but you can get it out of the way to run.
I know you weren't over there all that long of a time, but did you have any correspondence from home?
Yeah, I don't recall writing home for about 3, 4, or 5 weeks. And I don't remember. Yeah, there was always letters, but, you know, I'd get a letter from my mother, had a girlfriend, my wife, later wife, but I don't remember receiving mail too often.
Well, you know, I'm realizing now that you mentioned that, we skipped that chapter about the girlfriend. So you were sweet on her before you went overseas.
We knew, had known each other since we were 10 years old. Our parents worked for the same newspaper. And we had dated a couple times before I left. I can remember when I was in basic training, her brother was killed. And so I remember writing a letter to her. I don't call girlfriend, we were correspondents.
Right. But knowing what we know now, you know, if that machine gun bullet had been a little lower, or that mortar a little harder landing, you would have never come home to marry her.
Yeah. Well, we didn't dwell on that.
There were four sons that never would have been born, and some grandkids and great-grandkids, too. That's important stuff. So you're going day and night. You're exhausted. There's still enemy shells that are coming your way. Are you starting to get an idea that this might be over soon, that Germany's about to surrender? Were there rumblings?
No, what you're going through, you're seeing a lot of prisoners. You're seeing a lot of people that have been released from prison, the prison camps. You know, and the Germans just opened up the gates, and they're lost. And I got a good story to tell you about that. We'll get a little later. So you're seeing a lot of pitiful things. We would throw a tin can of rations. You'd eat it with a spoon, a fork, you'd throw the can in the ditch. Guys walking down the road would come and pick up that can and take their finger and rub it around the inside to get the grease, and that was their breakfast.
Wow.
So you see a lot of pitiful things. It isn't any fun to kick a mother out of her house either.
Oh, sure. But that's
what
you guys
don't think
had
about
to do.
It, but that's what I had to do.
And you guys don't know. There could be someone in the basement. There could be someone hiding.
You go through the house, you don't know. You know, so it's you're just doing a job, and I say you're tired. You don't dwell on those things. But you see the awfulness of war when you see the mother and a couple little kids down there pushing a baby buggy, and that's it for their belongings.
Mm. And then you've got your mother back home in Michigan hanging a blue star in the window.
Yeah.
Were there days that you thought she might have to change the color of that star?
No, you don't dwell on that. You're invincible. You're only 19 years old.
That never wavered for you, huh?
No.
All right.
You know where you go for everywhere. You worry about your own protection. You worry about your guy's protection. You look at the ditch. You make sure you got a spot to jump to. But you don't worry it's ever going to hit you. You don't do that.
Of everything you faced, from cold weather to enemy machine gun fire, the mortars, artillery shells, was there one thing that bothered you the most, or scared you the most, or seemed the most distressing?
You know, as you look back at it, seeing Cowboy laying in the bottom of the boat with blood all over his face, you know, that's distressing. But, I didn't see anybody writhing in agony or any of that sort of thing. As I say, we were fortunate because we were clean up. We were not sitting out there in the middle of a forest for 6 days wondering whether you're going to get fed or not.
As so many others were.
As so many are. As I say, we had it easy.
And that's all relative, isn't it? I don't think most of us listening today would consider any of this easy. And there's still more to discuss with Bill Koning of Modesto, California. He earned a Bronze Star for Valor, by the way, because of his actions on that Easter Sunday patrol. He's thankful the Purple Heart didn't come along with it, but he would spend some time in the medic's tent later. Bill didn't share that with us, but his friend Ralph Cole's book tells the story of how Bill injured his leg while riding on a tank. I have a link to that book for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, where you'll also find a photo of Bill with his Bronze Star and a medal he values even more than that, his combat infantry badge. And we're going to hear the rest of his story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
You hear a lot about World War II if you listen to Hometown Heroes, but have you ever wondered what it's like to be on a real World War II ship? The SS Jeremiah O'Brien, one of just two remaining operable Liberty ships, is docked at Pier 45 in San Francisco's famous Fisherman's Wharf, and the O'Brien is offering overnight programs on Fridays and Saturdays for kids ages 6 and up. Kids get to sleep on the ship in World War II bunks, have a private tour of the ship's galley, the crew quarters, guns and gun mounts, exhibits, and the crown jewel, the O'Brien's triple expansion steam engine. This is an experience like no other. For more details, call the SS Jeremiah O'Brien's office at 415-544-0100. That's 415-544-0100. Or visit the ship's website at ssjeremiahobrien.org.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Bill Koning of Modesto, California is our guest today. Originally from Grand Rapids, Michigan, he served with the 86th Infantry Division in Europe during World War II. The Black Hawk Division was supposed to go to the Pacific and had undergone extensive amphibious training, but the impact of the Battle of the Bulge increased the need for infantry units in Europe. The 86th saw its first action along the Rhine River in March of 1945, went on to fight through the Ruhr Industrial Valley and into southern Germany. Your division was credited with liberating a forced labor camp at Attendorn. You weren't there personally, but you said you've got a story about American prisoners who were liberated.
A friend of mine, Bob Gleib, we're walking down the road, and here comes a couple in there, Air Force prisoners. We'd say, "What outfit are you from?" or something. Or they'd say, "Tell us who they were." So he said, 93rd Squadron or something like that. And Bob was walking behind me, and not behind me, Bob was off someplace else. I only can repeat this story as it happened. He was someplace else. And he asks one of the guys, "What outfit you from?" 96th. And he said, "Oh, my brother was in the 96th. He was captured. Do you know my brother? Who is he?" "Tom Leib." He said, "Yeah, he's right down the street there." And so the guy liberated his own brother.
Wow.
And so the thing they took him to, they brought him to our place and put him in our company headquarters, let him clean up, give him a good food, and then send him back. So he had one good meal in him, and he went. But anyway, it's just one of those little incidents that happened.
And with 16 million Americans 16 in
million
uniform.
And you find one.
How about that? That's hard to believe. What are the odds? Well, when you got that news that Germany had surrendered, what did that mean to you?
The future was still indefinite. You didn't know what was going to happen next. You were trained to say yes or no, sir. Mm-hmm. And you took it as it came. And there wasn't anybody saying, "Oh, now we can go home and go to school." Nobody doing that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It just happened. I can remember the lieutenant coming and saying, "Hey, the war's over. But you still got Japan."
Exactly. And I want to ask you about that, but now with 70 plus years of hindsight, and I know you were only there for the last 3 months of World War II in Europe, but you told us how close you came to not coming home, and you were part of this larger effort to liberate Europe from this Nazi regime, to free prisoners from all those concentration camps, those that were still alive, that your ancestral homeland, where your grandparents came from, the Netherlands, that it was liberated because of you guys over there. Is there something that you take pride or satisfaction in with regard to what you did in Europe in World War II?
I take pride in being a soldier in World War II. I do take pride. I stand straight on that. I was lucky, very fortunate. And if I really want to get mundane about it, I can say I was saved to do something. But I can. I have had a very good life. Had four beautiful children, wonderful wife, went to school, got an education, ran food plants for General Foods all around the country. And so, that was my want in life. I'm very proud of what I did. Yeah, from that standpoint.
Mm-hmm. And at the time, so you're a 19-year-old kid still, and they bring you guys back to the States because there is still a war going on
in the
Pacific.
There's still a war going on.
And you guys were going to play a pretty important role in that war in the Pacific.
We were going to invade the Red Beach in Japan, Tokyo. I saw the orders one time, and where we little red star where we were supposed to go in.
So your outfit was going to hit Tokyo, which of all the places in Japan that they would want to defend, there you go. Yeah. And the defenses would have been heavy and insane everywhere, but you guys would have gone right to the heart of Tokyo.
Yeah.
You guys were training, and you guys were actually...
It was really a smart move on their standpoint. We knew amphibious training. We were blooded, and we were the ones of us that last knew combat. We knew when to duck, and so it was a smart move as far as the Army is concerned. So they brought us home, gave us a third-day furlough, and came back out to California, and I was advance party aboard the troop ship, and I looked down over the top, and the people are all dancing in the streets because the atomic bomb had been dropped.
And to your point, so people understand what you're saying, you guys were uniquely qualified because originally you were going to go to Okinawa. You had all that amphibious training. Now you've had the combat experience in Europe. That's over. So of everybody out there, you guys were one of the best options for that task
they
had for you.
That's right.
But when you look over the side and you see them dancing in the streets of San Francisco, you knew you weren't going to have to go anymore?
You didn't know that yet. We didn't know that until we'd been aboard that troop ship for 2 weeks. We're sitting out in the middle of the Pacific going to Japan, and the airplanes went overhead VJ.
They formed that in the sky?
They formed that in the sky. And so we took a left turn and went to the Philippines.
Wow. Now, I don't want to be, melodramatic or put thoughts in your head, but I'm just wondering, of 72 years since then, has any year gone by where VJ Day rolls around and you don't look up in the sky and visualize that?
Yeah, I can see it.
How big was that? I mean, that sounds surreal.
Well, as you see airplanes doing things, I don't know, elevation-wise, I can't tell you. They had formed a VJ up there, and they were flying around the island.
So then what did you guys do aboard that ship?
Oh, they cheered. I don't remember. And landed in Batangas in the Philippines. And from then on, it was goof off. And put us in a camp. I can remember getting a pass one time and going to Clark Field and seeing the guys laying against a bomber. A big bomber that came out. It was a B-29 or something like that. Mm-hmm. Hadn't seen that before. And then I was signed an advance party for, they were going to reconstitute the Filipino Scouts. And I was going to be advance party for that. And so I was one of those selected. So we were in a camp where they were going to come in at some point in time. So I had half a dozen guys, cooks and a lieutenant. And suddenly I was the first sergeant in the headquarters company of the new Filipino Scout. And I didn't know even how to keep a sketchbook. And I can remember grizzled old first sergeant who called MacArthur Doug and Eisenhower Ike. He'd been in the Army that long. He was the battalion sergeant, and I was a company sergeant. But I really didn't know what I was doing. I didn't have any knowledge of it. Really got one of the biggest, finest chew in my life. We had to provide guard duty because they were afraid. There was something called the Huck Bellahops in the Philippines. I guess they were communists, and they were kind of raiding places. So we had to put people on guard duty, and so I did it one time, and my cooks had to go out and be guard duty. That was the unfortunate thing, that they stood at attention in the guard thing before they went out, and the colonel of the outfit came through, and he inspected them that Sunday afternoon. And so they came up to the guy that was standing there with a pistol. He didn't know what to do with it. I had told him he could carry his pistol because he was going to drive a Jeep. He wasn't going to be able to fire his rifle. He didn't know how to fire a rifle. He was a cook. And so I told him he could carry that pistol. He didn't even know how to show the colonel that pistol, how to open it or anything like that. And so the colonel called me, told him to get me, and they came running in. I was taking a shower, and I got dressed up, and I got the best tune I've ever had. He went up one side of me and down the other. I was going to lose all my stripes, I thought, and he didn't take my stripes away.
The damage was done. He got his point across. So how long did you stay over there, and what was your involvement with the Philippine Scouts?
Wasn't any. They never had any come in. We goofed off every day.
You just got to hang out until they sent you home.
Hang out until they sent us home, and that was, I was discharged in April. But in the meantime, the guys I'd been all in combat with and my squad and all that sort of thing were back in this camp in Batangas. They had athletic programs and all that kind of stuff going, and I was just sat there and looked at the walls of the tent for 12 hours a day.
How good did it feel to come back home?
You were glad you were going out. You were going to be done with it. You didn't have any thought of what school you were going to. I can remember I had no thought at that point in time. I knew I was going to go to school, but not where. You had no idea what the GI Bill would mean. No, you're just glad to be going back home.
Was that a pretty lengthy hug from your mother when you showed back up in Grand Rapids?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
And what about Phyllis? Were you a little more serious about her once you got back?
Not really. We saw each other on occasion again. We dated. She was at Ann Arbor, and I went to Ann Arbor because of her. I'm sure of that.
So you get a mechanical engineering degree at the University of Michigan. You go to work for General Foods. Everyone knows Battle Creek is famous for cereal, and you once managed the cornflakes.
Yep.
You didn't pee in anybody's cornflakes, did you?
No, not really.
Do you know where that expression began?
Yeah, in the pickle factory.
Really?
Yeah.
And that launched, as you said, a long career with General Foods. That's what brought you here to California in 1970. You've been in Modesto ever since. And eventually, you and Phyllis got married.
Yeah.
Had almost 66 years of marriage before you lost her. Now you got kids and grandkids and great-grandkids. Have you ever had that thought? Boy, this whole life I know, all these descendants, that none of this would have happened if those close calls were a little closer?
Oh, yeah. You think about it, but not in any mountain way at all. It's lucky.
Well, and you said that if you really think about it, maybe you were
saved for other things in this life that you've had.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. Is that something you think God was protecting you?
Yes, very definitely. He had something planned. He usually doesn't tell you what he's going to do.
Funny how that works. But his plans are always better than ours, once we see it. Well, and anything else that you think is relevant, I want to hear. But you had an opportunity here a couple years ago to travel from here in California to Washington, D.C., with Central Valley Honor Flight, see the World War II Memorial and other sites in the Capitol. In fact, we're sitting in your office, and there's a picture of your whole group on the wall there. What was that experience like for you? What were the things that stuck with you?
Well, I've always been proud that I was an infantryman. Very proud of that. Now, I couldn't have been in the Air Force. I wore glasses. My eyes weren't good enough. I wore glasses in about the sixth grade on or something like that. And so I've always been important. So I feel that I'm something special when I stand next to that Air Force guy. And yet I had it easy.
Well,
and I have no idea what they did. I've talked to them, sure, and I've got friends that were pilots and all that sort of thing. But I've also been proud of it as an infantryman because I really did experience what it is.
Well, and you've shared that with us and helped us get a feel for what it was like. And you mentioned the people that you knew who were killed, and even that your eventual wife's brother was killed in this war. When you were in Washington, D.C., at the World War II Memorial, and you look at that big wall of gold stars, 406,000 Americans who didn't come home, didn't have the life like you've had. What did you think about? What were the things going through
your mind? It's a deep thought that you have. I didn't have tears in my eyes, but it was a very emotional thing for me. And I think about that, those 4,000 stars. How do you explain that to somebody, what it is? You can't do it, really. I had an opportunity to talk to some high school kids, and you get to that point, and there's no way I can express it. At least I haven't found a way to express it.
Yeah, you're in a city, Modesto, with the population that's about half of that.
Yeah.
Take a couple Modestos and just wipe them out.
Yeah.
That is hard to fathom. Did you find yourself reflecting on some of those individuals you knew that represented that number?
No. It just, you wish you could take everybody and have them stand right there and look at that thing for 5 minutes. Just to realize, and particularly the people that are running this country. And you know, we got a president now that's going to throw the army here, going through them there, put them there, here. And hey, go to that wall and stand there for a little while before you shoot your mouth off.
And right underneath that wall, it says in big capital letters, "Here we mark the price of freedom."
Yeah.
Well, that part of your journey was a sobering part. You described it as a deep thought you felt there looking at that. I'm sure there are some other parts of those 3 days you had on the honor flight that put a big smile on your face.
Oh, yeah. I enjoyed the, I had a real good buddy looking over for me, and I saw my son, Tom Madison. He joined us, too. So, I had a lot of fun. I'd recommend it to anybody.
For people listening, your son, Tom, is not only an Army colonel, he is a West Point graduate.
Yes.
Did your Army service in World War II have something to do with his wanting to go to West Point?
I don't think so. He was an alternate to West Point. He applied when he was a senior in high school, and he'd go through all the rigmarole. Yeah. He applied to the Air Force. And so he was not chosen for the Air Force, and he was an alternate to West Point. So he got in by the skin of his teeth. He's a very dedicated Army person. I'm very proud of him. He's very upright. Nice kid to have. I got four beautiful sons.
Again, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. I'm just wondering if you can help us understand what it was like to share that experience with your son, to go to those places with your son in our nation's capital and reflect on the service that both of you have given to our country.
I'm very proud of him, and he was ready to so-called lay down his life, and I don't think he ever had a thought that's what he was doing. It was just his duty to do whatever he did. He was in Iraq, head of the Corps of Engineer Work for the lower third of Iraq, traveling in a Continental, armored bottom, armored tank, armored glass. Wherever they went at 90 miles an hour, and he had to patrol his third of Iraq that way as a colonel in that car through those people, some of whom were stealing the wire off the poles and the pumps and wouldn't work because they stole all the copper out of the wire from the pumps. He had to deal with sometimes with some of the sheiks that were head of the little towns and fixing the water pipes, fixing the power pumps. Mm-hmm. The engineer did a lot of work there. So I'm proud of him.
I know he's proud of you too, as well you both should be. Well, and I guess that's one of my other questions, and I need to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling
You're
us
welcome.
This story, and helping us understand it. What are you most proud of when you look back at almost 92 years now?
That I was able to survive. I was proud of being a soldier, yeah. As you look back at that, I'm proud of other things too, but I'm proud I served. I'm proud I was in combat. I put my life on the line. I was willing to do that. I'm not willing. I was ordered to.
Is there something, you mentioned going to speak to high school students, and you said you'd love to take all the leaders of our country and let them sit there and soak in the World War II memorial. As far as those of us alive today who didn't live through World War II, is there something you think we need to know or something that's most important for us to realize or remember about what you and all those other Americans did?
Oh, I don't think I get that deep into those kind of thoughts. I wish there was some way we could make people understand that the military is not another set of cops. This is somebody that's out there putting their life on the line for them. It's also a good place to become a man, and a lot of these high school kids need that.
Well, I know it worked out pretty well for you, and you are a sterling example for those young people to emulate. Bill Koenig, soon celebrating his 92nd birthday in Modesto, California. Find his smiling face at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.